It's good afternoon once again to the Planning Commission on Higher Education. Glad to have you. Wanted to actually take a moment to welcome one member that has been with us but not officially, and that would be Chris Brule. And also David Walsh, who actually is a new appointment. So welcome to the commission. Nice. We're delighted to have you. And Meg, I'm sorry, forgive me. Lousy chair, what can I tell you? But we are glad to have all of you as well, too, and this is a particularly good time. One just caution, please, to remember, if you are to speak, please make sure you use the red button. And the reason why that's even more important today, if you haven't figured out, we're in another room, and there's a computer screen at the other end of the room, and we are actually Skyping to Colorado with Ames McGinnis, who is one of our new colleagues from NCHEM. So welcome, Ames.
Thank you.
And you will meet shortly Dennis Jones from NCHEMS. But let me ask for an acceptance of the minutes from the last meeting, please. I have a second. All in favor? Any opposed? Minutes are accepted as written. Thank you, Jeannie. At this point, I think it's would be very helpful, yes, to introduce. And again, the reason we're in this room in a rather different setting is we are Skyping, and we had also thought that CTN would be here. And we understood from CTN, were we to Skype in our normal hearing room, that our attendee from Colorado would appear blue. Mm-hmm. And not wanting to do that on his first meeting, we decided to change our venue for the day. So I wonder if we can start down at the other end, Judy, and tell us who you are and what organization you represent, please.
Hi, I'm Judy Goldfarb. I'm a member at large, appointed by the governor, and
I'm Judy Goldfarb. I'm a member at large, appointed by the governor, and representing early childhood.
Hi, I'm Tim Leggett. I'm the ranking member on the Higher Education Committee, and I haven't been here for a few meetings, and so I apologize for that, but I'm pleased to be here today.
And I'm Judy Resnick, and I hopefully try to chair this meeting occasionally.
Hi, I'm a State Representative Roberta Willis. I am the House Chair of the Higher Education and Employment Advancement Committee.
Sally Reese, Vice Provost for Academic Affairs at the University of Connecticut.
Christopher Brule, I'm the President of the Business Council of Fairfield County.
Braden Hosh, I'm with the Board of Regents for Higher Education.
Jason Jakubowski, Vice President for Government Relations at Hospital for Special Care.
Bagus Hajmichael, Fairfield University.
John Shima with the Metro Hartford Alliance.
Lois Schneider, Management Consultant.
Judy Grimen, I run the Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges.
David Walsh, Professor Emeritus of the Connecticut State University.
Meg Green, I'm here on behalf of Commissioner Catherine Smith from the Department of Economic and Community Development.
Marissa Morello from the Department of Labor, representing Deputy Commissioner Dennis Murphy, who sends his regrets.
Hi, I'm Terry Kelly. I'm with the Office of Policy and Management, and I'm here representing Secretary Barnes.
Terrific. Thank you. So for those that were not able to join us last month, you'll remember that we were able to announce that we have, in fact, successfully engaged a consultant to help us as we set out to write a strategic plan for higher education in Connecticut. And we are delighted today to be able to bring our consultants to work with us and begin our work here. But for those of you that don't know, NCHEMS, which is the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, submitted the winning proposal. And Dennis Jones, who is here today with us in person, and Ames McGinnis, who was here via Skype, are our two key, both Dennis is the president and Ames is a senior associate, and Patrick Kelly will also be working on the project with us as well. this is an organization that I think we are all thrilled to welcome into Connecticut. They have been here before. They have experience with Connecticut. But more importantly, they have a tremendous reserve of knowledge and expertise in higher education across the country and have been involved in similar strategic plans and related types of operations in a number of states throughout the country. But more important to know is that not only were they essential in helping those states develop those plans, but they have also been asked to work with those states in their implementation and ongoing. And that's really, I think, very significant in terms of their expertise. So we want to welcome you to Connecticut and are looking forward to your guidance as we go through the next year in preparing our plan. So with that, I think I'd like very much to formally welcome Dennis. Glad to have you fresh off the plane, not only from Colorado, but from Kazakhstan last week. So he's done some real serious traveling. And I'd love to turn the meeting over to you.
Thank you. And Ames and I are both very pleased that we can participate in this activity with you. I mean, this is what NCHEMS does, and this is one of those moments in Connecticut history where there's an opportunity to do something that makes a difference. We get lots of opportunities to do things like this, and most of them we don't do because they're fool's errands. We don't think this one is. So we are particularly interested in the opportunity to work with you. this started, 3 weeks ago or thereabouts. We've been pretty active since then. We've had conversations with the chair, with Representative Willis. We met with Judy Grimen, have had conversation with Braden and UConn folks talking about some data that we need, and we're getting close to having that in hand. So they've been very, very helpful in all cases. We've begun a bunch of analysis, some of which I'll share today, more of which I'll share at the next meeting. That will prompt the conversation about goals. And we've scheduled additional conversations already with President Gray at Connecticut State College University System tomorrow, meeting with Braden tomorrow. Ames is coming to Judy's executive committee meeting next month, so we are meeting with the private independent sector. So all in recognition of the fact that these kinds of activities only work if an awful lot of people are touched and listened to. This is not a technical exercise. At the end of the day, this is an exercise in broad leadership. And one of my early mentors told me that leadership was not about finding consensus, it was about creating it. And I think that we come at this from the perspective that we start with the Planning Commission, but at the end of the day, an awful lot of people have to sign on to whatever it is that you select as goals, or at the end of the day, they don't get done. People always use the metaphor of everybody needs to have somebody driving the bus and other folks need to get on it. That's not the way higher education works. Much better metaphor is that we have to build a good canoe and hope that folks row in generally the same direction, because that's how you make progress in higher education, is that an awful lot of folks, all who have the capacity to veto, will in fact sign on and help you make progress toward really important goals. just I will share some things with you here in a minute, but before I get started on that, I want, you know, you've seen the proposal, but I want to kind of go back and give you an indication of how we go at this process, because I think that will help put everything else in context. First of all, yes.
Dennis, just one thing too. It's the majority of the Planning Commission has actually not seen the proposal. There was a small subcommittee that was created for the selection process, and based on our contracting laws, we were not allowed to share that until after the contract was awarded. So they have actually not seen the full proposal.
Okay, so even more important for me to share the general process that we will go through. First of all, we are talking about a strategic plan that starts with the unit of analysis being the state of Connecticut, its businesses, and its citizens. It's not about institutions in the first instance. Eventually, we get there, but institutions are means to important state ends, and the question before the House will be, what does the future of Connecticut need to look like, and what does higher education have to do to help the state get to that desired end? So, you know, and I understand that, you know, that the systems and UConn will necessarily do their own strategic plans. We will try not to step on any of those, but at the same time, the reality is that none of them are starting from the state from their perspective. They are getting paid to worry about the institutions in their systems. This is an overlay on that. And we've learned over and over again that adding up institutional and system plans does not a state plan make. That you really have to deal with this as something that starts with the state as the unit of analysis. The process we will go through in very short, let me just give the brief version of this. Through data analysis, we will paint a picture of the state of Connecticut for you. And we'll talk about demographics, we'll talk about economy, we'll talk about regional variations, we'll talk about subpopulation variations. We'll put you in a national and international context, and then ask you the question, if you would like this picture to change, you know, if you were to look at this picture 10 years from now, what are the most important things that you would like to see changed? What part of this profile would you hope would be different if you revisited this after having pursued this strategic plan for a decade? Ames and I have been involved in way too many planning exercises where they start with a blank sheet of paper and no data and ask a group like this to say, what do you think the priorities ought to be? And my description of exercises like that is like, you know, doing planning with both feet firmly planted in midair. There's just no basis for, you have no starting point. And so this meeting and the next meeting in particular, we will share with you a bunch of data. And all the way along, you know, your homework is to say, what about which of these things that you see before you would you hope would change? What should be the priorities for the state to change in this profile that we're going to paint for you? Certainly by the end of the December meeting, we hope that you've got a tentative list of goals that we will talk our way through. You know, and when we talk about a list, we're talking about 4, 5, 6, no more than that. This is not a list of micro things. These are the big things. If they're strategic, they are going to take lots of years to address. They aren't something that can be addressed in a single year, a single legislative session, a single governor's term. These are the issues that are ongoing and need continuity and continued attention. But at that point, we will start involving lots of other stakeholders. We'll deal with the presidents of the institutions, public and private. We will talk to the faculty groups, the student groups. And then we will have regional meetings designed to listen to employers, local political leaders, school superintendents, largely as employers more than as educators at this point. And we will also meet with the regional college presidents, but in a separate meeting, because we have a different set of questions. We'll come back. We'll, you know, and the question in those regional meetings will be, here's the basic data that the Planning Commission saw. Here is the conclusions they came to tentatively. Did they miss the boat anywhere? If you were to tweak this, how would you tweak it? And the reality is that it will stay 95% intact. There will be nuances picked up that make a difference regionally, that we'll learn some things about, particularly the economy in the region, that don't come popping out of national or state level data. But mostly this is an exercise in that process of consensus building. Okay, it's a process of putting data in front of a group of folks, explaining to them what you're about, and getting their agreement around the set of goals that you're working on. And at that point, then we'll recycle. We'll start putting together a set of recommendations about what to do with it. We'll run that through you. You'll have lots of input into that process. And we'll go back to that same set of regional conversations and say, this was the set of goals we've talked about. This is what has been concluded needs to be done. Let's talk about your concurrence with that, you know, set of it, with that agenda. So that's the process that we propose to engage in with you. It's got lots of involvement of you. I mean, at the end of the day, you make the decision about what the goals will look like. You have to be engaged in this process. But it doesn't stop with you. We try to get lots of other players engaged as well. So that's kind of the short version of and one other thing. Alongside the data analysis, we'll also be doing a policy analysis, or policy audit, we call it, just to take a look at, because one of the questions is, if these are the goals to be pursued, how do policies in place align with that? Is there anything about the accountability process for higher education that asks the questions about the goals you put in place? Is there anything about the funding mechanism that actually promotes pursuit of those goals? And in the regional meetings with the college presidents and administrators, we will ask the question, if these are the goals, what is there that's in the way of pursuing those? And one of the things we've learned over the years is that in most cases, it's not new policy that's required. It's about 100 old policies that need to go away. There's there's just an awful lot of time, energy spent in doing things that are long forgotten as to their rationale for being in place. There are lots of things, you know, that get in the way. I'll give you an example. I talked about it this morning with Representative Willis, and she said that may be true here. But we were doing some work in Tennessee, and one of their real questions is, how do we increase the number of adults coming back into the higher education system? And we started talking about why the number was so small. And one of the reasons we discovered was a state law, not an institutional regulation, a state law that mandated that all students, when they register, had to provide an immunization record. Now, here are these 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds showing up at the admissions office being told that they can't register without that. You know, I mean, their pediatrician has been dead for 20 years. They have no idea who it was. They have no idea where to get those records. They walk out the door and never return. You know, there are all kinds of examples of things like that that get in the way of the goals and objectives that you put on the table. And it's those kinds of things that make a nice laundry list of things for a legislature to reconsider. And it's a way to make real progress without spending a lot of money. So, I mean, it's out of this comes a useful agenda in that regard. It's not just about creating new stuff. It's about clearing the underbrush. So, any questions about the journey we're about to embark on with you? Does this make sense?
I should say that Senator Beth Bye has joined us. The Senate chair, co-chair of the Higher Education Committee. Welcome, Senator Bye. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Okay. With that, then let me start down the path of sharing a little bit of data with you. And this is a small part of what we've already done, but I'm mindful that this is an hour and a half meeting. And when we get into this, there tend to be questions, and so please feel free to interrupt at any point and saying, what does this mean? Is that really true? What is this anyway? So feel free, okay? This doesn't do any good if you don't get it and understand the picture that's being presented. So, if one compares Connecticut with both other states and the OECD countries, OECD is the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. It's the association, basically, of the developed economies of the world, Western Europe, Japan, Australia, the U.S., etc. But there are some others, like emerging countries like Czech and Slovak Republics, Mexico, and some others that are climbing into the club. Connecticut shows 46% of its young adult population having an associate degree or higher. That puts it above the national average by about 4 points, but it puts it well, and it puts it 10 points behind Massachusetts and way behind countries like Korea, Japan, and Canada. And this is 25 to 34 year olds. If you take a look at 25 to 64 year olds, the U.S. and most of the states look better in international comparisons. And the reality is that if you take a look at the retiring population of, you know, U.S. baby boomers, about that same 40 or 44% have a college degree. The United States has not moved more than an inch in the last 40 years as far as decade by decade education attainment improvement. If you take a look at that same age cohort in Korea, about 10% of that group has a college education, which means that the U.S. is still among the best educated populations in the world, but it's because us old guys got educated, not because we're doing so well with our young folks. We're 13th or thereabouts with regard to educating our young population. And if you saw the article that came out today where they took a look at an assessment of the skill levels of adults, the United States showed even much worse. Numeracy were 21st out of 23 countries they measured. Literacy, I think it was 13th out of 23. So not only are they not getting degrees at the rate of other countries, we're not learning as much as our residents of many other countries. So this doesn't paint a pretty competitive picture for the U.S. If you take a look at this overall, Connecticut is, just on the basis of 25 to 64 year old college degree attainment, you're doing quite well, thank you. So what's the issue, right? Connecticut is fourth in the U.S. as far as education attainment of its population. And when you look at the pieces, you know, you're still doing pretty well. You're at the graduate professional level, you're way up there, well below the national average of folks who drop out before they get a high school diploma. So, you know, one of the real issues here, most states, is the number of students who start college and don't finish anything. And, you know, that's a much, you know, there are twice as many people who start college and don't finish than there are who start and get an associate degree. So, you know, that's a very large chunk of the adult population. It's a, when you think about workforce development, education attainment, that is a population to think about. And I will show in a minute that Connecticut and its higher education system historically do not address the adult population. It's a higher education system geared to 18-year-olds and all that goes with that. And part of the question that we'll ask is, now what is there about policy and funding and everything else that makes that the case? Or is it just New England culture? Okay. You've made a teeny bit of progress between young adults and older folks, less than 1%. So the younger population is just slightly better educated than their parents' generation. If you take a look over the last 10 or 11 years, Connecticut has in fact gotten worse. And one of the things that you will see is that lots of the states that have gotten worse are states that have shown major chunks of in-migration of folks who have less than high school, let alone less than college education. And lest I remind you, or do I need to, that college attainment is not nicely, evenly scattered across this state. We'd take a look at it by census tract of the adult population. There's one census tract that has an adult population college attainment level of 95%. Practically every adult in the census area has a college degree. There's another one that has less than 1%. I mean, enormous regional variation in this state. And you just take a look at the South, South Fairfax County is a different world than the northeast corner of the state or the eastern part of the state. And it raises questions about economic development, opportunity, education. There are lots of regional kinds of things that one asks in this context. Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. A quick question about that one slide showing the population by census tract. Do you know if that has trended one way or the other over the last 10 years? Is it pretty stable?
I don't know. We can probably find out, although right now we can't. The federal government has shut down all the databases. The Census Bureau is not partying with things like this right now. So it's a little difficult. But experience in other states is, while the numbers change, the patterns don't change much. South Fairfield County is still going to be the richest part of the state 10 years ago. Yeah.
Just to follow up then, can we assume that the layout, the grid here, is driven by the placement of higher educational institutions?
Mm-mm.
Not at all?
It might be some in the more rural parts of the state, but in other places it's driven by the job market and who lives there and what kind of occupations are they filling and are they commuting to New York City for high-end jobs or not, because this is based on population that lives here, not necessarily that works here. Okay? This is now where we start, where the picture gets a little less rosy for Connecticut. This is the difference in college attainment between whites and minorities. And for this case, we're saying minorities are blacks, Hispanics, Native Americans. Asian Americans look just like whites. But Connecticut, there are only two states in the country that have a larger gap between the whites and minorities in education, college education attainment. One way of looking at this is that about, let's say, 50% of the whites have some level of college degree, associate and above. If 50% of whites do, 20% of Hispanics and African Americans do. And it's gotten worse over the last 10 years. It's 1.5% worse now than it was then. So the gap is not closing, it's broadening. And the gap is even bigger for the 25 to 34 year olds. If you take a look at the younger population, it's not 29% anymore, it's 34. And this is the set of folks that are going to be in the workforce for the next 30 or 40 years. And it's gotten larger over the last 10 years here as well. Yeah, look.
It's the same pattern, though, exists in all the states. Is that true from looking at this data?
It's
that this issue is an issue across the country, not just in Connecticut? Is that
well,
a fair statement?
Let's put it this way. It's twice as big in Connecticut as it is in places like Florida.
But
that has a very diverse population. Okay, it's 34% here, 14% in Florida. Massachusetts is way up there, but states like Maryland are below the national average. Virginia is. Michigan is. You know, at the low end of this scale, like West Virginia, the gap is small because nobody has a college education. It's not that the minorities are so undereducated, it's that everybody is undereducated. But that's not true in Virginia. That's not true in some other states here. It's not true in Missouri. It's not true in Hawaii or it's a bigger issue, I would argue. And whether or not every state has the problem, I would also suggest that this is the workforce you will have. So whether everybody else has the problem or not, it is an issue for the state. And the other thing to remember is that the less education you have, the less mobile you are. So those are the folks that are most likely to stay here. If you take a look at education attainment by race, what you see, as I said, was white and Asian looking almost exactly the same at all levels. But take a look at the green bars. 28% of the Latino population in the state have yet to finish high school, let alone gotten into college, as compared to 4% of whites. So African Americans, Hispanics are way overrepresented at the low end of the education attainment level spectrum, way underrepresented at the upper end. 29% of whites have a college degree, 14% of African Americans, 9% of Hispanics. So 3-1. And when you take a look at the projected change in population, the projected number of whites in the prime working age population will in fact to be smaller in 2025 than it is now. All of the growth in that age population will be people of color. So to the extent that you will have any increase in population, it won't be the folks you're used to seeing. Take a look at the red line, the second one down, how much drop-off there will be in white high school graduates between now and 20 years from now. The overall number is going down. The white population is going down dramatically. To the extent there is any increase, it will be African American and Hispanic. Connecticut's, once they get them out of high school, everybody goes to college. They go to college at about the highest rate of any state in the U.S. Mississippi is the only one that wins. And they get rid of everybody before they get to high school graduation. But the two that graduate go to college. But of the states that have high high school graduation rates, Connecticut sends a very high proportion of its students on to college, not necessarily in Connecticut, but someplace. But only two states send a smaller proportion of eligible adults to college than Louisiana, than Connecticut. Louisiana and New Hampshire being the two below you. And if we use here, we just take a look at the population data that says what proportion has less than a baccalaureate degree in the population. And then in the numerator is what's the proportion of the 25 to 44 of that same age cohort that are enrolled in college. And states like Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, Minnesota, California, you see lots of states at the left-hand end of this that have, Utah is, you got to kind of take that one out of the conversation. What you see is an awful lot of students coming back from Mormon missions as adults that are enrolled. I mean, that kind of skews the Utah number. But places like New Mexico, Arizona, Minnesota, California, Illinois, Oregon, these states have very active, particularly community college systems that really align their offerings with the adult population. They're very workforce oriented, very active, and in some cases like Arizona and California, Illinois, very large community college systems. A high proportion of their students go into the community colleges. Only two states in the country, New Hampshire and Vermont, send a smaller proportion of their recent high school graduates to in-state institutions. So a lot of students from here go someplace else to go to college. They go to college, but not necessarily in-state. If you take a look at the sectors, all of them are growing. Community colleges growing faster than others. But in all sectors, Connecticut is a net exporter. So this says that more students leave the state to go to research universities than students from other states come into UConn. More students leave the state to go to state colleges than come in to go to the four state college institutions here. Many more private students go to out-of-state private institutions that come than come in to the private institutions here. And this is where, at least 2 years ago, this is the list of where they go. And most of them are in neighboring states. I want to talk just a little bit about the kind of, we would call it the education pipeline, but the progression of students through the system. Connecticut is way up there in the proportion of students that graduate from high school, better than the U.S. average, not much behind the highest performing states. College going rate, as I said, is right up there. In fact, it's at the average of the top five states. Much lower in participation of 25 to 49 year olds. Then on the right chart, what it says is that, I'm going to start on the right side and work back to the left. The Research University of UConn graduates students at higher levels than most public research universities. The state colleges, better than the U.S. average, not equivalent to the best in the country, but it's the community colleges that come up much less successful in graduating students relative to the national average, relative to the national best performance, against national best performance at about half the rate. This is another way of saying that same thing. This is for the 50 states. This lines them up. Rather than use six-year graduation rates that have lots of problems in the calculation, this says how many undergraduate awards in a year divided by 100 undergraduate students. And, you know, if you were to, and by the way, the states below Connecticut, Florida, Washington, California, Illinois, those four, their research universities do very, very well because they take a very large number of community college transfers. Okay? I mean, they have all four of those states have huge community college systems that transfer a lot of students. So the University of Washington looks really good because so many of its students, they graduate a lot of students that are only there for 2 years. I haven't seen the Connecticut number yet, but I don't think they look like Washington, California, Illinois, or Florida. So that says a lot about the students that start at UConn and stick with it. The state colleges come back to the national average. And the community colleges fall toward the very bottom of the list. Now, having said that, when we take a look at the degrees awarded in the course of a year, Connecticut is low at the community college level, high at the baccalaureate level, and one thing that I will draw your attention to, it doesn't register in the certificate category. And that is a direct correlation, I will argue, to the lack of service to adults, because those are the programs that adults come back to take. They're workforce-oriented programs. They're things that an adult can come into higher education, get an economic leg up in a short period of time. This just says to me that there's a mismatch in the delivery, in the supply and demand of education at that level in this state. I'm sure that when I start talking to college presidents, they will say, you don't understand. But we'll have that conversation. Less than half of the baccalaureate degree holders that live in Connecticut were born in Connecticut. In fact, 40%. 60% came from someplace else. And one of the things that you find, I mean, there's a few states down at the very low end where nobody gets educated and et cetera. But if you go down Washington, Oregon, Maryland, Virginia, Colorado, Washington, others, these are all states with hot economies, have had good economies over the years. They attract folks from someplace else. And so the fact that Connecticut has a lot of imports in one way reflects a strong economy, because folks don't move here for no job. So, or they get a job in New York City and move across the state line to live. I mean, there's a lot of that in Southwest Connecticut. So, and interestingly, if that same picture holds true for associate degree holders, that's a little less typical, because associate degree holders are less likely to move. And this is one where oftentimes you find that cost of living in the nearby metropolitan areas are so out of sight that folks with skilled trades, backgrounds, and et cetera, can't afford to live there. So they move across the state line where they can't afford it, particularly if transportation actually works, at least sometimes. And, you know, this is the average net migration of students in to Connecticut over the last 5 years. And what is interesting is that you import both talent on the one end and lack of talent on the other. You import a large number of folks with less than high school education.
Could you explain that a little bit, Dennis, if you don't mind, why qualify that?
No, I'm just saying, if you take a look at the numbers over the last 5 years, per year, Connecticut imports 2,500 people a year with a little, and these are adults, 22 to 64 year olds, that have less than a high school education. They also import 2,000 that have a baccalaureate degree and 1,900 that have a graduate degree. So you import lots of people with college degrees, but you also import lots of folks with less than high school.
It's just puzzling, I think, you know, to think about it, because this is a high class state, and usually you wouldn't think that you'd do that.
I don't know enough about Connecticut specifically, but I've done some work in Rhode Island. And one of the things we learned there was that this population started in New York City and has been kind of pushed up I-95 further and further. And there's a set of low-level service jobs that they take, and they've migrated away. You know, they just migrate up I-95 to where cost of living is manageable. And, you know, I don't know where in Connecticut they, but I suspect they go further east than elsewhere. I mean, this is supposition based on experience someplace else. I'm not going to say I know that in the case of Connecticut, okay? But obviously they're here. Colorado's got some of the same very bimodal behavior. On the one hand, you see lots of folks coming in with baccalaureate and graduate degrees to work in the high-tech economy. And on the other hand, you see a lot of folks coming in to swing hammers to build houses for those folks. And that construction trades folks tend to be less than high school educated, many of them immigrants.
That's very consistent with our understanding of the Fairfield County economy. The state doesn't collect regional data in the way states with county governments do, so my organization does a lot of that work. So in the city of Stamford, for example, almost 130,000 population, a third of the adults with a four-year degree, 25 years of age or older, are foreign-born. Only a quarter are Connecticut-born. And 60% of the children born in Stamford Hospital, the only hospital in the city, over the last 6 years, 60% are born to foreign-born mothers. And 56 languages are spoken in the homes of families with children in the public schools. So it is a bimodal distribution, very highly educated and very low educated, and all of them have a role in the economy because of the need for all of that labor,
yep,
all of that talent.
Thank you. I wasn't too far wrong. So, you know, we're not going to answer this one today, but take this home, think about it. Next time we're going to start talking about how to fill in what some of these might be. We'll give you more data next time so that the list can get longer. But I want to get out of this. I want to do one more thing in the time that's left. This takes a couple of minutes to load up, but I want to. This is a model that we've built that kind of says, okay, if you pull this lever, what does it yield by way of degrees at the end of the pipeline? Where are the places where action gets you the biggest bang, if you will, okay? And what this says is, first of all, that it starts with an assumption that by the year 2025, Connecticut is going to need 66% of its population having to have some level of education beyond high school. Tony Carnevale, a labor economist that a lot of us know, we trust him more than we do most labor economists because he really does understand higher education, I think, better than most. Right now puts Connecticut's number at 64% in 2018. So I ratcheted up 2 points in 7 years, but I think this is in the ballpark. We can quibble a percentage point or two, but for purposes, that's the number this model is interactive, so we can play with it and change that number up or down and see what happens. And by the way, Jeannie has this model, et cetera. It can be made available. You can have it to play with to your heart's content. What this model says is, given the demographics of high school graduates and et cetera going down over this period of time, if Connecticut does nothing to improve either high school graduation, college participation, or college throughput, you will actually have 25,000, 23,000 fewer graduates in 2025, not more. The numbers of graduates over that period will go down, not up. Largely because the high school population is going down. Okay? Then, you know, we can say, okay, higher education loves to pick on their K-12 counterparts and says, okay, if we move high school completion to the best in the country and college participation to the best in the country, lo and behold, we turn that 23,000 negative into a plus of 9,000. That's presuming nothing happens in higher ed. Okay? And then if we move the college going or completion rates in the public 4 years and in the private to best performing in the country, we get it all the way up to 63,000. And if we, on the basis of 18-year-olds, move the community colleges to best performing in the country, we move it to 148,000. It's still 75,000 short. So if you do everything you can in high school, everything you can with 18-year-olds, you can't come close to hitting education attainment targets that the Connecticut workforce will require. The only way you get there is to move a lot more adults into and through the system. And it has to be not only to best performance in the country, it has to be above, you would have to be the pace setter in that to make this equation work in Connecticut. Now, the good news is, if you were to do something like that, I'm just gonna back up over here, and I want to do one other thing. Let's just talk about moving the high school performance to national best level. Do nothing in higher ed. One of the things that happens, and this is a picture of state costs versus revenue. So this is a kind of poor man's ROI calculation. It shows increases in per capita income, but it also, and it shows additional revenues generated to the state, but it also shows Medicaid savings and correction savings. Okay, so it's not just revenue, it's foregone costs associated with a higher educated population. And if you do it only through high school graduation, don't change college. One of the things that it does is say for the state, it's not a winning proposition, because it essentially puts more students into college with no more productivity in the collegiate sector. Okay, so you're putting more students in at current costs. There are no savings in all of this. But if one comes back and does all of the other things we said, the rate of the return to the state is about 4 to 1, 4.5 to 1. It will cost a couple hundred million more to educate that many more students, but the state will get about 900 million back per year. Now, that presumes that folks are going into the marketplace at current rates. And, I mean, there's an awful lot of assumptions buried in this. But the fact of the matter is the more students that you can get through the system, the higher proportion of those that start that finish, cost is kept down, productivity increases, costs less than more students at no productivity increase. and the benefits to the state and to the individual are substantial. But what it basically says is that the real point of all of this is, at least my takeaway, is Connecticut has to worry about adults. It has to worry about college completion of students that start. So, you have had a taste of what we do. Questions? Is it making sense?
Do we come out of our funk?
Well, you know, you should, you know, you could be in Louisiana and watch me do this, where the governor calls me Dr. Doom.
We would concur. I think Judy Goldfarb had a question.
Dennis, thank you so much for putting numbers and pictures to things that we have assumed and have thought about. For the last number of years, I've been particularly concerned with educating the Hispanic population, and primarily because of a language piece. We've talked about age, but we haven't talked about language. And with the Hispanic population in this state growing 12 times faster than the general population, those swings will increase, and I don't know whether you'll address some of those strategies or where you're looking at the language.
We have to.
How does workforce and the types of jobs that are going to happen in Connecticut or anything to do to affect the job affect these kind of models? You've seen this play out in a number of other states.
And yeah, I mean, the economy makes an enormous difference in how this is what is, what will be, we don't know. But one can take a look at, you know, and Tony Carnevale has, you know, you start with what do you think will be the growth industries over the next few years? Then you ask the next question, what's the occupational mix within those industries? What kind of jobs are held by those industries? And the real question, and why I listen to Tony Carnevale more than most labor economists, he goes, because that's what BLS does, Departments of Labor in the States. Those are the two calculations they make. What Tony has done is gone the next step and said, what is the education attainment requirement of those occupations, and how is that changing? So, you know, folks who fixed cars used to be able to do it with no high school education, let alone a college education. It's increasingly hard. You know, the occupation is still auto mechanic, but the education attainment requirement or education content of that job is way higher than it was 20 years ago. I mean, you don't see gears and levers and springs anymore. You see computer code and computer diagnostics. You don't do machining with an old-fashioned lathe anymore. It's all computer control. So the job content of somebody who carries the same BLS occupational code is way up in almost all occupations. And so, you know, we will take a look as much as we can about where folks think the occupation, you know, where the industries are going and what's likely to happen. Tony's done a lot of that work state by state. We will rely heavily on that, but it's one of the reasons we do regional meetings with employers, because we say, okay, this is what the data that we can get our hands on tell us, but make us smart about what's going on around here that these data don't reflect. Help us understand that. I mean, the nuance of these things are important parts of why we have these regional meetings and why we really want employers involved.
Can you say a bit about the model you use to link educational attainment and state revenue or state economic welfare?
Yeah, I mean, these are all state-specific data, so they're not national. And they are based on education, on income tax and other payments made by folks with different income levels or educational levels. So it's what's the average income tax paid by a baccalaureate degree holder? How many more baccalaureate degree holders are there? Income tax goes up. What's the average Medicaid bill for students or for individuals in different income levels? One of the realities, I don't know, at the national level, I don't know what it is in Connecticut. If you have less than a high school education, the probabilities of your tapping Medicaid in any one year is about 1 in 3. If you have a graduate degree, the probabilities of tapping Medicaid are 1 in 33 or thereabouts. It's 3%. So, you know, the less education, the more likely you are to be incarcerated. So, you know, we've got state-by-state data from the National Criminal Justice Database. So those are the things that, and they are state-specific. So these are not national averages. Okay? Senator Bayh, you had a hand up.
And maybe it's just the way you keep the data, but I think one of the things in Connecticut is that race and poverty are so highly correlated. Obviously, there are differences in populations, but that's the way it runs here.
Yep.
And in our school district, you know, that's a real challenge to try to break out poverty and race. And so when I look at your data about the attainment of different minority groups in Connecticut, I try to think, is there a way to control for poverty, you know, and or look at it by poverty? Is that just an artifact of the data we collect? Or is there a way you can look at it by poverty as well?
We're going to bring income data into the stuff we talk about next time. I mean, we've got some of that. I'm just not quite ready to share it. But yes, I mean, and if you take a look at that map by census tract and say, let's take a look at income, you can't tell the difference between those two maps. Okay. Highly correlated. Highly, highly correlated. Okay.
Yeah, and this comes from, I think, us being a very small state geographically. But one missing variable, one thing I don't want to see missing as we continue to go forward is this idea of, and we've talked about it in previous meetings, this idea of infrastructure and how these trends that we're projecting end up affecting the bricks and mortar that we utilize here in the state of Connecticut. I mean, you're talking about possibly.
When you talk about infrastructure,
we're a very sensitive state when it comes to infrastructure. Who's building what, where, when? Is the state
you're talking about
something?
Higher education.
In higher education. I mean, if you could say if we're talking about, one of the scenarios has an extra, 203,000 degrees. Where do we fit those people in the state of Connecticut? Is the state footing that bill? Are private institutions footing that bill for their own institutions? Or if 25 years from now we're going to lose 22,000, what do we do with the structures that are existing? Are we downsizing? Just saying, from my perspective, Connecticut is a very sensitive state when it comes to
how well I know.
It's a bricks and mortar.
Not only is it sensitive about having it, but it's a question of whose is it?
Yeah.
I've been down this path. But again, the large chunk in the numbers of these are going to be adults. And they're going to be adults that are going to have to be served. And that means they're going to be served where they are. They're going to be served in very different ways. And bricks and mortar may not be nearly as important in serving that population as you've become accustomed to in the dealing with 18-year-olds. And, you know, if you take a look at, you know, I've done a lot of work in New York right now, and, you know, New York has a public college or university on every block. I mean, you know, SUNY has 64 campuses. And the real question there is, how do you better serve New York with that enormous set of assets without building new institutions? I mean, you've got institutions within reach of everybody in New York. I mean, there's no place that is left out of the reach. But the question is, how do you bring SUNY Buffalo to Potsdam to offer a course? How do you bring community colleges from one part of the state that have from Binghamton, where they got real expertise in manufacturing, to some other part of the state that needs that same skill? And as you work through it, it's not about building brick and mortar. It is about, I mean, the real issue is, and I think the chancellor has become persuaded, that the real answer is, how do you create fiscal incentives for the institutions to, in fact, work and play together rather than compete? You know, that this really is, how do you pay an institution to invite somebody else in to serve a need that they aren't prepared to serve? I mean, it's those kinds of, I mean, at the end of the day, we're going to have those kind of, going to have those kind of conversations about state policy, because in the end, the real policy in higher education is more about fiscal than anything else. It's about how money, not how much money, but how it flows. And, and therefore, the question is, what incentives or disincentives are built into the funding models, and how do you change that? That really become part of what you are going to have to talk about.
I have one question I'd like to ask. Here?
I'm sorry.
Thank you. My background is political science and political economy, and I retired as a full-time professor in 2009. I retired as a union president for the Connecticut State University's professionals, basically, in 2010. And in the interim between 2009 and present time, I never saw so many changes in higher ed as it has occurred recently in Connecticut. Not only personnel changes, which are sometimes common, but also changes in structure and in institutions, new governing boards, each institution coming, set of institutions coming forward with some new goal, and, you know, tracing our progress in the U.S. News and World Report and all the rest of it. If ever the term non-system could be applied to the higher ed process in Connecticut, it seems to me it's now. My question is this. This can be looked at both as an opportunity to, within this obviously changing situation, come up with a really solid set of priorities like you're suggesting. But it can also be a real negative, because the level of political penetration here and the political change and the jockeying for position seems to me to be more overt and stronger than it's ever been before. I know you're just beginning to study Connecticut, but do you have any feelings about particularly the changes that have taken place? Is this a good time to be doing what we're doing, or is it a time that's perhaps politically not as fortuitous as some others?
Yeah, I guess I would say that there's no perfect time to do this. That I think Ames would agree that we don't go into this thinking about governance at all. That this is not another opportunity to change governance. We've got a long history of saying, we only recommend governance changes if we're convinced absolutely that nothing else can work. that it's just too disruptive. You really want to make what's there work rather than try to pull up the carrot every week and see if it's growing, because that will just keep things in turmoil and fibrillation forever. And, you know, you don't need that. You need stability. You need continuity. And so the question is, how can any of this help provide cover for that to develop, I think is part of it. You know, we've watched the changes in Connecticut over the last few years. I think we'd raise the question why, but it's now done. And so now how do you make what's here work, I think is kind of where we're coming from.
Can I ask a question as well? I'm interested in the place where disruptive technologies fit within the work that you're going to be doing over the next number of months. I don't mean simply, you know, the popular phenomenon of the MOOC, but the overall transformation of the higher education model that seems to be suggested by so many people is inevitable, and that we can the business model, and that we can adapt to it or not without fully having an appreciation of how that's going to play out in Connecticut. How does it play out in your work in the months ahead?
We certainly will look at alternative ways of doing things. You know, and I will reveal my bias about the disruptive technology. It's not MOOCs. MOOCs is, I would say, it's, you know, going back to my high school days, for crying out loud, it's correspondence school on steroids. But the real disruptive technology, as a matter of fact, is competency-based degrees, where it is assessment of competencies. It is degree granting based on that. That is the real disruptive technology. And that MOOCs play into that. So do lots of other things. But the fact that the federal government is now taking some of the constraints off of places like Southern New Hampshire, Northern Arizona, Western governors, other such places, and saying, you know, we will find ways to not have you count credit hours but count competencies. We'll find ways for your students to get Pell Grants based on that. That will change more than MOOCs will. It will be, and what will be really disruptive is at the point where assessment organizations that are not universities grant degrees. Okay, because at the moment, the sole competitive advantage of a higher education institution is it's the degree provider and therefore certifier of something that has traction in the workforce and in society. But if that same level of credence is given to competency-based degrees coming from someplace that's not a traditional university, then the higher education as we know it has lost its last comparative advantage.
And we have a version of that, of course, in the state already at Charter Oak State College.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think when you look at the numbers and look at the population to be served, there's going to have to be some part of the delivery model that's not like what you're currently seeing. Yes, sir.
Looking ahead, I mean, the data you've shown are pretty grim for Connecticut. Looking ahead, you mentioned earlier that you would need to bring everybody on board, college presidents, publics, and private institutions and so on. Private institutions in particular have accreditation requirements and so on, and I'm afraid that it's going to be a difficult battle for us, for the commission, for you to make them do what needs to be done in accord with our data.
Well, I mean, the reality is all institutions have accrediting requirements. Public, private, I mean, they all face the same accrediting bodies. So, you know, the at the end of the day, the question will be, can the state of Connecticut fashion a policy environment that doesn't make anybody do anything, but that says, I volunteer to do that because it's in my institutional self-interest for me to do so. You know, I mean, if you just take a look, you know, how far it is from the governor's office through the legislature, through the board of trustees, through the president, through the vice presidents, to the college campus heads, to the deans, to the department chairs, to the faculty members. That's a very long list of folks who can veto progress at every step. Okay, they don't have to be overt about it. They can just kind of ignore things. And at the end of the day, things won't happen. Okay, I mean, so, you know, the only way that this kind of change works is if institutions and faculties inside those institutions see this as being part of their own self-interest. Okay, and that means you create a set of policy, you know, a policy environment that encourages certain kinds of behaviors and doesn't reward others. I mean, I sit in front of lots of legislatures, and you know, we talk about their funding models. And you heard me say it in New Hampshire two weeks ago. You know that in most states, the way the money flows, a college president would be nuts to graduate anybody. Okay. I mean, because the more students you bring in, and the longer you can keep them, the bigger the share of the pot you get, whatever the pot is. Okay. And because tuition is such a big piece of it, even more important that you get them in and keep them there, as long as they'll keep shelling it out. And so, you know, how do you change that dynamic? And you change that dynamic the way lots of states are now starting to do it, by paying for degrees, not for credits. You know, for paying for completion or a chunk of it. I mean, there are ways to do this that change the dynamic. It changes the dynamic around articulation and transfer. That if you pay for completion, all of a sudden those transfers look a lot more attractive than they did when before. So I mean, but that's for like January, February, March discussion about how, you know, what kind of an environment you create to in fact make the goals that you're looking for realizable in institutions' self-interest. That.
Forgive me for interrupting, but before we lose people, I wanted to make sure, Dennis, I know you want to charge people with some homework to do, and I also wanted to let people know, hopefully this will work for people, but the next meeting is going to be a very important one, and I'm hopeful that you will all be willing to give us an additional half an hour of your time and let this meeting begin at 2:30 instead of 3:00. Next time. I think it's a very important meeting to really begin to set there. So I don't mean to interrupt, but now,
no,
please.
You know, two things before we adjourn. Okay, and I know we're already over time. I want to ask Ames, is there anything that I failed to say that you need to remind me of, sir?
No, I think you covered it.
Okay.
I just, maybe one thing about the comment about the environment that's touched on governance. I've found that it really is refreshing in states we've worked on to actually begin to focus on the goals and the substance of what you're up to, because in organizational change, you get just totally lost in things, and people say, you know, what does this all really amount to? And it's kind of a hackneyed thing, but you've got to constantly say, what we're up to here is something that's going to make a tremendous difference for students in the future of Connecticut. And, you know, you can get all embroiled in the politics of things and kind of lose track of the ends. So one of the contributions I think you can really make is changing the nature of the discourse in Connecticut from being, you know, about who's on first base and what's organizing this about that, and say what we're really about is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So I think that's a very positive view, but I think you all can make a real difference in changing that discourse.
Okay, just two other things. I mean, the last slide in the first thing that we went through had 1, 2, 3. Start thinking about what these data say to you as about, you know, if you take a look at the picture you've seen so far, what are the two or three things you think most important to change? Okay, because eventually we're going to put these together in something that looks like a short list of goals. You know, the second thing, you know, that I'm presuming that there may well be either questions or things that you want feedback on or you want to say to us, that you want to send emails. My email address is in that packet. But I would encourage you to, rather than just send them to me, I'm sorry, Jeannie, but send them to Jeannie. Make sure that everybody sees all of this traffic rather than a set of bilateral communications, because I think everybody should see the same answers and see the same questions, if that's okay. So that's all I've got to say, except thank you for your courtesy and for your
thank you for
attention.
A wonderful presentation. Please, a round of applause. let me also invite everybody that is still here, since we've just sat for a while listening to such bleak information, that you may want to join us for a reception for Dennis and have a perhaps a glass of wine. So please know you're invited to come upstairs to the Capitol Room 104 to Secretary Merrill's office, please. Room 104 in the Capitol. Please join us. It's a welcome to Connecticut. Ames, sorry you can't partake.
Yeah, sorry.
Virtual alcohol.
Wine for me.
But we will.
You don't need one.
Thank you all, though. Any last questions, comments? Terrific. Thank you. And we will see you. And again, 2:30, please. On the next meeting is set on November 12th, please.
Yeah, and we'll both be there.